Hello, Sam.
Hello, how's it going?
Okay, not sure how long I'm going to be able to be on today, but good to
We'll
always.
take all we can get.
There we go. Deeply appreciate you running these, though. Always enjoy hearing your voice.
Well, hopefully they're useful. Today's Canada Day, and so I think we might have
Ooh, that's right.
an appropriately low showing from our Canadian friends.
That's true. Well, at least they can go to Europe.
Yeah.
Actually had that affect me recently.
The lack of ability to travel.
Not that I really want to, given these conditions, but so there's kind of an important meeting in August, and my board basically said, you might not be able to attend, Jack.
Yeah. Yes. We'll see
So
how this goes. I was wondering about IW earlier and how that's going to fall out, and it's probably too early to know, but.
no American in Paris, basically.
Right. Yes. All right. Keith and Steve. Good. Although, with just Jack and I on, we could get a lot accomplished.
I don't know about that.
Well, I don't mean to slow you down.
No. That's always the joke because you get to make the decisions with fewer of you, right?
That's right.
Since, decisions here have the effective power of almost nothing, but it's the getting alongness that matters, not the decisions. We're having our first sunny day after about 4 days of rain. So that's nice. And snow up on the mountains. So what a way to enter July is with snow on the mountains.
That's awesome. Down here in Utah Valley, we had earlier in the week, we had two fairly major fires, and the whole valley was full with smoke. And then
Are
that
those
night it
mostly out
rained.
now? Oh,
Yeah,
good.
they that night that they both grew really big, like we couldn't see across the valley. And then that night it rained a little bit, and the next morning I'm hearing that they're 100% contained. So, and I
Yeah.
don't see any smoke. It was, I thought we were in for the long haul of bad air.
I noticed, Steve, that Utah is having earthquakes and fire. What are you turning into, California or something?
It's all the Californians. They're moving here and they're bringing their
They're
experience.
bringing their earthquakes and their fires with them.
It's a whole new level to, Californians turning another state into their state, right?
That's right. I'm a Californian by birth, so I can joke about these people.
I am too. I am too. Although I'm from Northern California, which may be a different California depending on your persuasion.
I've lived in both. My early years were up near San Francisco and later down near in Bakersfield.
I am from Petaluma. That's about as far north as you can go in the Bay Area and still call it the Bay Area.
Yeah, nice. It's a
So
good area.
it was a good area. I can't even remotely afford to live there now, but it was a good area to grow
Yeah.
up in. I lived on the older side of town and not that far from the town limit, so it's really easy to get out into the country from there and all that. So it was good.
That's where Leo Laporte does his show from.
That is where Leo Laporte does his show from, although I've never met Leo Laporte.
Actually,
So.
I saw Doc Searls was on there the other week.
Oh, I should go look that up.
Yeah.
I have listened on and off through the years, but I've never met him. I was my claim to fame is that I was the 98th subscriber to cable modem service in the entire Bay Area back when cable modems were new. And I know this because at some point, you know, the original company had been sold and sold and sold like three or four deep. And my parents wanted to like add a second computer. This was a long time ago still, onto the cable modem. And the lady said, oh, it should just work. Just plug it in. They're like, it doesn't work. I was home from college. I called in, I had them send a service tech guy out, and he looks at the modem and he's like, no way. He's like, I can't believe this is still running. And he showed me the back of it. And it was the first major cable modem deployment, I think, of nearly everywhere, although I'm not entirely convinced of that. And then they, for fun, they did the deployments. It was one company doing the deployments for the entire Bay Area, and Petaluma was one of the starter companies because they didn't want all the fiber companies that were popular at the time there to take over the town. And so they deployed in Petaluma first, and the serial numbers they handed out in order. And so on the cable modems, it started with something, 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 zero. And I was the 98th serial number on the cable modem.
That's great.
So that's my claim to fame. We might have a really small group today. But that's okay. We're here and we can talk about some good stuff. I know Daniel Hardman texted me and said he'll be about half an hour late, but he is planning on being here. I should post about in the channel just in case, you know, people forgot. The infuriating thing about that tech call was that I called in support, and the lady said, well, if it's our fault, like if the modem really is old, then we're going to replace it for free, and it's a free service visit. If it's not, then you're going to have to pay a $100 service charge. And I said, fine, totally. I'll pay a $100 service charge if I'm wrong. And this was pre-cell phone. So I left. Well, I didn't have one anyway. And so I left to go run an errand right after the phone call. And she called me back 5 minutes later and said, I couldn't bear the thought of you paying the $100. So she canceled the service visit, and I had to call in again the next day and schedule one. And then the guy showed up and immediately identified as the oldest cable modem he's ever seen and replaced it.
That's great. That's great. I work tech support at my University of Maryland. And we used to have an inside story when it was the user problem. We actually said, oh, it's the fatherboard.
Nice. Very nice.
They didn't know what we were talking about, of course, but yeah, fatherboard error.
Right. My favorite acronym for that one that I heard a long time ago was this problem is a picnic. Picnic stands for a problem in chair, not in computer. All right, folks. Man, when the Canadians take a vacation, it really shuts the world down. So let's get going. Welcome to the July 1st Aries Working Group call. We have some cool topics, some that were delayed as requested because of the said Canadians that were taking vacation today. But so we've got some of those for next week. Please mind the Hyperledger Code of Conduct and the antitrust policy. Let's get along and care for each other and avoid encumbering our work that limits its use. I've got the wiki page in the notes if you'd like to make any adjustments or anything. Anyone new today that would like to introduce themselves? All right. Well, we're glad everyone's here. Happy Canada Day. That's why we see fewer Canadians in our call than usual. They are taking the day off. And so, yes. So related meetings review. This is the week of the Identity Working Group call, right? Did I get that right, Steve?
Yes, Identity Implementers call. In addition to our normal call reviews, Oliver Turbu will be there tomorrow to talk about PSYOP. And we had him scheduled last week, but he had a last minute conflict, so he'll be there tomorrow for us.
Excellent. So, and he was talking about PSYOP.
Yes.
That's right. Perfect. Okay. I'll report on the DidCom working group. We are making lots of corrections and fixing stuff. We had a handful of PRs that stretched in good conversation over a couple of weeks, and so a lot of those got merged and put in, and that's starting to nail it down a little bit. This next couple of weeks will be actually a pretty big movement to get the rest of the bulk in there and make some adjustments. We had a period where we started to add DidExchange and then didn't in favor of some zero round trip policies or implementations that actually eliminate, I believe, the need in DidCom version 2 that we're working on over there for a DidExchange to actually occur. We still get all the same stuff, but it's a little bit simpler of a protocol with some additional consideration. So that is one of the things that we've been talking a lot about. Other meetings. All right, upcoming releases and work updates. It's probably faster to go with those that are here. So Jack, I see you typing. Would you like to talk about Aries SDK Ruby?
Yeah, so continuing on the JSON-LD 1.1 work, I'm also looking at the BBS Plus stuff because they use Rust and I have a Rust bridge for that. So. And then I haven't put these in, but the last thing is trying to think. Yes, okay. So there is a new, I'm going to say new Ruby library as of 2020 using external KMSs for encrypted, basically encrypted fields in backend ORF. I'm really excited about that. There's this guy at Instacart that's actually the Ruby developer, Andrew Kane, K-A-N-E. Does anybody know him? Yeah. So see if I can connect with him. But he has a new thing called Lockbox. It was in January where he released it. But it actually interfaces with external KMSs to do key rotation, column-based encryption, it's a very rich toolkit. It's called Lockbox, and it's a Ruby gem. So I'm taking a look at that and how it could be combined in the work here.
Very cool.
I will put links to that.
Other work updates that I know of, 052 did actually ship from ACAPI with some stuff in here, which is quite cool. So there's some work there. And then I actually have a demo of upcoming stuff for the toolbox today. There's also stuff that was mentioned on the morning meeting by Robert, I believe, that talked to that they've got some plans to merge in their alternative build path for a web application as opposed to an Electron app. And so that's going to end up in the same repo, which is really cool. And I have a demo a little later talking about the some of that stuff as well and what we're building. And as it relates to mediators, that will be kind of fun to show. That is not yet done in Merge, but it's on the way. And I wanted to kind of show it and get some initial feedback and see if I made any critical mistakes there. Tomislav, you are here. Any news on .NET Framework? Framework.net.
Yes.
Set that backwards.
We're about to publish a PR that adds API extension to the Aries framework. It's more of an application level feature rather than anything related to a protocol.
Cool. Awesome. Any other work updates? Keith, I see you. Anything on the test suite?
No, nothing new there. Just working on some interoperability issues with, from our side, from Evernym. And I think there were a couple of that Evernym was working on as well. But if we could discuss at some point today, I'd be interested in knowing your take or others' take on the BBS Plus applicability to Aries, et cetera.
Sure, I could give you a really quick one now, or we can have a longer discussion later. Any preference there?
It's, I don't know if anyone else is interested. Yeah. If you want to give a quick one, and then if we want to go into further.
It's a good topic.
It's super good topic. Here is my read of the community's response. People like it. In BBS Plus, it doesn't offer all of the same things that Indie does, but it offers some things that have never been available outside of Indie before, which is really exciting. It is based on JSON-LD based credentials, which are not in themselves evil, but JSON-LD is a little bit of a beast if you've never encountered it before. And so that is cool. There's some early work. One of the things that's in 0.5.2 is some signing and verifying support for JSON-LD based credentials. That's not BBS Plus, but JSON-LD, which will be a foundation for the BBS Plus stuff. And so there seems to be really, really good interest from the BC Gov team and from others on it. There was a brief conversation about whether we should apply the BBS Plus signatures things natively onto Indie credentials. And the short answer is that until all of the features like predicates appear, it's not a direct suitable replacement on Indie credentials, but it's certainly a great credential format to use in addition to Indie credentials. In particular, the JSON-LD credential world is pretty darn excited about it because they like the features of Indie, but they don't like the infrastructure of Indie. And so this gets us sort of a little bit of a meeting ground, which is kind of cool between various communities. So that's a bit of a short summary.
So with regard to, I was trying to think of the things that are missing. And of course, predicate proofs is the big one, which seems to be a point in time statement from what I was hearing. Hopefully, but there's also at least there's no versioning. Direct versioning support, but I think that would be trivial to just come up with a convention, right? To say issuers must share this version attribute or something.
Right. It depends on how the version's actually shared with the JSON-LD schema.
Okay.
So you could do it by sort of imposing stuff backwards onto JSON-LD. Or at least the application of JSON-LD, and that may be a solution for the versioning piece in particular.
And Sam, I was watching, actually watched Tobias's video yesterday over again, and the choice of JSON-LD is just for ease. They actually, he outlines a JWS as being another possibility, but they haven't implemented that.
It could, but the JSON-LD has a lot of desire just because of the people that are already doing JSON-LD-based credentials. So you could actually apply this signature scheme in a variety of different ways, but it hasn't really happened yet, mostly because the one they picked to start with was such a good choice, I think.
He pulls that out specifically in his presentation.
I didn't recall that. The other thing that's missing is, and he acknowledges this, you can either issue, like Indie, you can either issue to a DID or to a link secret, basically. And their initial actual implementations use a DID because right. there's a lot of desire for that. And so the ability to do to a link secret is something that is not yet supported in the code, although there's no limitation except writing the code why that's...
Yes, he does pull that out explicitly in that presentation, the link secret. I'd love to see an example of that because... Anyway.
Yeah, so it gives you selective disclosure, but doesn't give you zero knowledge proof in the sense that you can hide your identity as long as you trust the context of issuance in the issuer.
Yeah.
And so... That's one of those things. So I believe those are the two main topics. There may be some little ones, but it's predicates, meaning greater than, less than, range type things, and the ability to issue to a link secret instead of a DID.
Yeah, and it's counterintuitive that the proof gets bigger the less information you're disclosing.
Yes, that is interesting. But the speed benefits are huge, and the compatibility and the ability to work alongside JSON-LD stuff is really huge. So I have not really heard any, with the exception of the missing features, I've not really heard any negative reactions from about anybody in the community. There seems to be pretty good interest.
And not having to, at least from a security standpoint, put cred defs and schemas on the ledger, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm calling them inline schemas when I try to describe them to people.
There is some discussion about whether the mutability of that is a problem. right? A JSON-LD context can simply link to a web resource. And if you decided to change that, it would kind of screw the universe up. So there's some discussion about whether or not that's a problem. But that's sort of been mostly ignored.
Right. Yeah. It's, I don't see Jonathan Holt on here, but I've talked about that with him. Yeah.
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 So I think we could get there with BBS plus signatures. For example, predicate proofs is just a, you need to come up with a numeric encoding for things that are not already numbers, and then you could actually do predicate proofs against them.
Sorry we're off the rails here, but from what I'm reading, just as from a user perspective of this, they seem to be compatible with the way Indy does things, right? Whether you're going to sort of inline schema or have a published cred def. I mean,
kind of. So Indy, the creds 2.0 effort on Indy adds a whole bunch of really cool expressibility stuff and gains the advantage of immutability. And you can do JSON-LD based on immutability, but it just hasn't really been done. You could also, this is kind of clever, you could actually come up with a translation between Indy on ledger resources that presented, that caused them to present as a JSON-LD schema, which would get you both the immutability and the compatibility with JSON-LD. So there's some interesting approaches there, and really all they need on all sides is just the work to be done.
I see. It's not quite so side by side yet. Okay.
Right. So the concepts are very side by side, but from an actual implementation perspective, there's some work to do to build those links.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. Thanks for asking. Today was a good day for that. Okay, other work updates. All right, our agenda today, Thomas Shelton is talking about credential exchange load testing. I wanted to briefly talk about RFC 348, which is the Transition Message Types HTTPS Community Coordinated Update. I have a quick, here's a bit of an outline for there was a discussion in the ARIES Interop channel about including profile information in invitations for an improved user experience, and that topic is an important one. I'm not sure we have all the right people, but I can certainly sort of brief on what the conversation has been like, and then we can talk about some of the factors that are involved there. And then I have a toolbox mediator routing demo that's kind of fun, not a very long one, but it shows some neat things that haven't really been available for the open source mediators that we've got. So that's our agenda. Any adjustments Nate, before we get going? All right, Thomas, this is where I stop sharing and you have the floor.
All right, cool. Can you guys hear me?
Yep.
Yep. All right. What am I sharing? All right, so what I'm going to do, just give you a quick background on what we're doing at CU Ledger. And then we'll do a run a quick demo of some of the testing harnesses that I've set up. So we've created a thing called the Member Pass that helps credit unions authenticate their members so that they don't have to, go through the standard 5 question entree every time somebody calls in or walks into the branch, right? So the strong authentication helps them reduce fraud, very interesting for them. We've seen some deployment in the call center so far, and what used to take 90 seconds or more to go through that list of 5 or so questions to verify that the person on the other end of the phone was actually who the owner of the account, we're seeing around a 15-second response time now when they're using MemberPass. So that's taking a lot of time off the amount of calls that they're getting.
Hey, Thomas, can you share how widely this is deployed? Is that something you can share?
Right now there's, I guess I can. There's one credit union actually using this in production. They're rolling it out. And I think we've got over 2,000 members using it. And that's going to grow over the course of the next couple of months. We've got quite a few credit unions lined up ready to go. The current quarantine whatever you want to call it in the US or worldwide, has actually pushed a lot of them to move faster with this because they don't want to touch driver's license. People aren't, you know, when they come into the bank, they're wearing face masks. So we're actually seeing a surge in credit union interest in this because of the strong authentication.
Cool. Thanks.
Situation. So there's that. So we're trying to put it across all the different channels. So when you walk into the teller, they can request some information there. When you go through the drive-thru, we'll do the same thing. And the call center is an obvious use case. So we're looking at using the QR codes, the out-of-bound processes when they walk up to the teller windows, kind of doing the same thing with the drive-through. And then when they call in, they provide a member number to the agent. The agent will send an authentication request back to them, and they'll say, yes, I'm on the phone, or no, I'm not on the phone. So the agent back at the credit union knows pretty quickly if they're actually talking to the person that called in. So we support all of this with a few code libraries. The main API itself is the Java VCX wrapper running on a Docker container inside of an Azure VM. We've got the libraries themselves that we use to showcase the tools, and we hand that back out to the credit unions to help them get up and running quickly. And we've also got a couple of applications, simulators, a web-based Node.js application that actually shows all of this in action. And we've got the mobile SDK from the mobile side to help some of the credit union system integrators. They don't want to use ConnectMe. They want to actually embed this into their applications that they've already got on the phones. So we've got quite a bit of code. And right now, our team consists of me and Daryl. And Daryl's probably 20% of the time doing this stuff. The other 80%, he's talking and showcasing and being Daryl. So there's a lot of stuff going on. When we provision a new client, there's a lot of stuff that we have to do in Azure, you know, get everything set up, the endpoints, the OAuth, allowing the clients to actually make the call, setting up the databases, Docker instances. And we've got manual ceremonies around the actual DID creation and credential definition setup. So each individual credit union gets their own specific credential definition. So as you can see, there's a lot of stuff going on. So we need a way to, when I stand one of these up, I need a way to quickly test that it's doing what it's supposed to be doing. And, you know, that was good initially, but now that we're seeing this ramp up in usage, we need a way to also do a little bit of stress testing to make sure that we can handle the loads that are anticipated to be coming through. So we created a Python test harness that basically watches a queue for any connection requests, and then we'll spawn a handler to handle those. And then the connection handler itself will go off, verify the connection, and then look for specific messages, and then respond to those messages. And there's a fun sequence diagram that gets into it, but I think we'll just jump in and look at the code real quick. My desktop. Yeah. Okay. So what we're looking at on the left-hand side is the server portion of the testing harness. So it basically, this is what we talked about, it just looks for connection requests, and then it will spawn a new thread to handle any connection request for a specific member ID that's coming in. So the 123456 is the actual member ID, and you'll see what it's doing as a new request comes in. And then over on the right hand side, we can say, I want to test this endpoint and give it a specific member ID. If it finds it, it'll use it. if it doesn't find, it'll create a new connection, create a new wallet, provision all the new information that it needs to be able to service that request. I'll run it real quick and then we can jump in and look at the code and ask some questions if you want. So I've submitted a new request, and then over on the right, you see that it's setting everything up to handle the request. We've actually got it set up so that you can simulate a certain use case. So we can say when you get a connection request, wait for 5 or 10 seconds before responding. When you get a credential offer, wait 5 or 10 seconds before responding so that we can run up a lot of different scenarios and how it's processing the requests. It looks like we got a successful authentication back. So that's a way for me to test an individual endpoint, but we can also just spin up, we can pretty quickly spin up like 50 different connection requests and have the pool processor manage all of those. So we can get some load testing to make sure that our servers are doing what they're supposed to be doing. Any questions? We can jump in and look at some code if you'd like.
So Thomas, one thing I would just mention, and that is a path that we took in terms of load testing, was at the high level, you know, we already had these tests that, you know, drove the issuance and verification flows, connection flows, of course. So the tool at the highest, at the top level, has a usage of where you just give it the number of issuers, the number of verifiers. Let's see, there are 4 arguments. The number of connections per, number of issuers, holders, and verifiers, and then a concurrency limit. And it basically just runs through this, you know, the issuance and the standard issuance and verification flows set with the, you know, subject to the concurrency limit that you give it. So it's been a useful load test tool for us. You know, it's obviously specific to our agent because, you know, we have to use the admin APIs to drive it right now. But I, you know, just thought I'd mention that it seems to relate to, you know, to your load testing paradigm here.
Yeah, that's a great way to think about it. This is just something that kind of grew out of what I was doing manually, and we decided to wrap some more code around it and to be able to get some more load testing responses from it. But this is very specific to ours as well, to our use case. So if you look at the way I was testing the endpoints, you know, this is basically the way that the tellers at the credit union would be using the tool. And then we specify the endpoint here that we want to test, for this would be a specific credit union's endpoint with their client secret and client ID to be for OAuth to log in. And then I mentioned a little bit that we had some usage scenarios. So when you establish the connection initially, you have to pass in the member ID for the credit union, but then you can also specify the actions that you want to respond with and specify timeouts as well. So when a connection request comes in, I want you to wait 10 seconds before responding. So we can do that across a number of different connection requests as well. Spread those out, make it look like a more real-time use case.
So that's awesome. Being able to like load test it and see really how it performs under those conditions is fantastic.
Yep. It handles pretty well up to 50 to 75 simultaneous connections. And the use cases that we're seeing, that would be a really high use case, you know, given the way that the people operate in the credit unions today. Once we get a larger usage from the call centers, that's obviously going to ramp up. And we're looking at ways to expand the architecture now to handle that. But this, you know, as we've just getting out of the gate, everything is let's make sure it's running. Let's make sure we can show it to people and then build the scalability as we go. Any other questions, thoughts? All right. Well, Sam, I'll give it back to you.
Awesome. I'd just like to note that Jack saw your demo and then left the meeting. I'm teasing. He had to go anyway. But the timing was good. Awesome. Thank you, Thomas, for showing us that. That's very cool. And being able to like script the interactions and the types of things that you really want them to be doing. It makes it the testing very specific and provides a lot of assurance for the, you know, the level of service you expect to provide.
Yep. It was fun taking care of it.
Very cool. And so cool to see this deployed in real users' hands. Like there's so much learning I'm sure that happens there. So that's a nice phase to be in.
Yeah, it's fun watching the credit union's response to this, especially given the current environment. It's, you know, they're seeing the future. They're seeing how this is helpful. The members themselves are actually excited about it. It's really cool to watch all of this unfold.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, those that are afraid of technology are, you know, think, oh, like I can get a virus on my computer. And now you're thinking, well, I can get a virus in real life, right? maybe the computer thing is a better plan.
Yeah.
So no, that's awesome. Okay. So the next thing I wanted to bring up briefly, I don't know that this is going to be a long conversation, is RFC 348. We talked about this. It was brought up at the end of last meeting. This is the community coordinated transition or update from using the old chosen DID to a base URL here. And that's kind of sat for a little while. And I've noticed, I don't think that this implementation table is entirely correct. I believe, for example, ConnectMe may have more done here. I don't know if you know more information about that, Daniel, or anybody.
Your question cut out halfway through, so I didn't hear it all the way. Something about connect.me and Daniel.
I don't know. This is the transition to community coordinated transition from, you know, for the message types. And it lists here as no steps completed for connect.me, but I believe there was some progress there, or is I mistaken? Did my question make it all the way through that time?
That time I heard the whole question. I don't know the answer, but I think you're right. I share your belief. So we need to get Richard or somebody on his team to answer the question, but I believe you're right.
Cool. Okay. So the reason I bring this up is that if we want to list, and Tomislav as well, I don't know, the street cred is listed as not it's number one listed as street cred, but also no steps completed there. And the reason I bring this up is that if we can update this and we have some confidence that the majority of the code bases have actually done this, then we can actually move on to phase two, which is we default to sending the new value instead of the old value. And that will, and that moves us forward in a really nice way. And that would be a good thing to do. It'll help sort of clean up some historical stuff as we move forward. And I think we've had enough time to make this happen. Any comments from anyone or feedback?
Do we have primary contacts for each of these code bases? Because if we're going to be maintaining these steps for at least a couple of phases, it'd probably be good to have a designated contact for each.
It actually might be useful for that. For example, the static agent Python is probably one I should do. We did do the toolbox, but static agent Python is one that I should do, and I haven't yet. So that's an example of the fact that, you know, applying a name to things really helps. What let's do for today is try and seek information if you've got it on where you are in this process, and let's get the table updated. And then when we have when it's not Canada Day and we have a few more people here, we can move that forward, discussion forward, and set a new and try and agree upon a new phase for this. And that way we can move forward. Does that sound good?
I would also add, if it's one of the open source code bases, we should probably hold the maintainers accountable to keep this up to date, just to make sure that it doesn't slip through the cracks.
Right. So, yes. So I'll bring this up, and I imagine we're going to bring this up probably weekly until we see significant progress on this, and we know our state more cleanly, and that will help a little bit. Daniel, at some point, you and I need to have a conversation about bigcom.org, but that's a separate conversation. The functionality of this doesn't really change substantially based on that. So, cool. Okay. Any final comments on the topic before we move along?
My final comment is, if people don't update the list, we should drop them from the list.
Yes. So this list in particular is just for, you know, the transition itself. So it's not as a big of thing to be dropped from this list in particular, but yes, I agree. If we don't have any contact or operation from someone, I think that's the right answer. Okay. Awesome. This was really just an awareness call so that we can, or call out so that we can think about that and try to move forward. I think it's a lot of work necessarily, but it will help us get there. The next thing I wanted to bring up was a discussion that was had on the in the Aries Interop channel on Rocket Chat this week, and it talked about the value of including additional information when you are offering a connection for the very beginning. And the common thing that is desired, particularly for a business, is to provide some sort of a logo to improve the user experience. Is anyone on the call part of that conversation? Okay. Since we weren't, I wanted to bring up just some brief topics. Maybe people will be listening, and for those of you that aren't, that you'll be a little bit more oriented to the problem. The obvious desire here is an improved user experience. If all you have is a DID contained there, then it's hard to know when it actually shows up on your phone that this is the person that you think it is. And we've talked about the inclusion of the label attribute, which is the function of this, is that you can provide a self-asserted or a suggested label for you that along with the connection. But from a user experience perspective, having some sort of an image is also desired. And I completely understand the improved user experience. There's a couple of problems or warning signs that go along with this that I wanted to articulate so that we can be mindful of those as we seek to solve the problem. And I think we can get to a good solution that provides both a good user experience, but we can avoid causing problems for our future selves. And so I've got three here, and I'll mention them. One is a little bit of an overlap with credentials. Typically, the way we talk about proving things to each other or providing that information is through a credential from an issuer that we trust. That's a little bit hard right now in the ecosystem because there aren't a lot of issuers that provide this type of information. So it's not like a business can actually go get a credential of both logo and company name from somebody and actually present that. We have a little bit of a bootstrapping problem at the moment because that isn't really there. Even if we were, self-asserted is not necessarily bad, except for the next two issues. One is a correlation risk. And I struggle with this one a little bit. I have an avatar, the one that's actually here, that I actually have an image file, and I use it pretty much everywhere I go online. So that way, if you find me in Rocket Chat or on GitHub, you see the same image, and that's helpful. Now, this works primarily because these are my public personas that I don't mind sharing, but there is a risk, particularly in the private sense, that if you provide something like an image that is fingerprintable, then that could be used to correlate you when you may not be aware of that particular vector. That's not a big issue for the common use case that was being argued in the channel, which is organizations. They typically desire to be correlated. There's not a real problem there. And having their logo associated when someone pulls them up is something that they desire to do. And if someone discovers that, hey, this is the logo of IBM when IBM's trying to do it, I'm randomly picking IBM, then that's actually a useful feature, right? But for an individual perspective, there is a correlation risk, and it's worth noting that as we proceed, so that we can guide people to proper boundaries about how this perhaps ought to be done. The second one is a problem, or the third one rather, that is a problem for companies, and that's a phishing risk. Is that if what shows visually is an image and a name, and there's not a tie to any sort of certifying authority for those things, and they're just self-asserted, then I could just copy yours, and when people see that I'm trying to make a connection, they think it's you, which is a huge classic phishing risk, and I think an important one, particularly for large organizations that want to do this. They want to have a good user experience, but what they really don't want is the user experience of someone ending up with a phish connection, and then all the privacy implications that come from that. And so I don't have a solution for that. As we discuss, we can figure that out, but those are the, I want the better user experience. I think that would improve things a lot. But I think that there are a few things to be, and there are perhaps some others, but these are the ones that I've been aware of surrounding the issue of providing these sorts of things to initiate a connection. I have one more thought, but any comments before I share my last thought?
One thing that would make me happier is to force developers to acknowledge the tension that we're trying to navigate. And one way to do that would be to change the names of the fields, to change them to be something like, fishable profile or unsubstantiated assertions about who I am. I don't know what to call it, but something that makes it really clear that, you know, in showing this to a user, they're signing up for some kind of risk that they need to manage.
I think we also can't deny the physics of it at the same time, though. For instance, Sam's here browsing a tab that says not secure, and he doesn't seem very concerned about it. So I think we have to be really upfront about what this is. It's just self-attested stuff. It would make me more comfortable if it was easier to put a verifiable credential or some other, piece of data there that could have some more authority in one way or another, at least in the long run. But I like the idea that you can put self-attested stuff there if that's what you need.
So I've got your name there.
Is there any reason why we couldn't proactively prove something? I know that in ZKP-oriented proving things, you must get a nonce. And Chappie actually also requires that there be a challenge from the other party before you prove. And there's an important cybersecurity reason for that. It has to do with replay attacks. So, but could you put data there in a form that you basically are saying, I'm willing to prove this to you once we're connected, ask me to?
So I actually had a conversation once, I forget who with, it may have been Tobias, about the idea of automatically generating a nonce that included something like a timestamp, such that it wasn't as good as a nonce provided by the verifier, but was better than no nonce at all. Meaning it shortened the window of the possible replay attack, for example, but was still better than absolutely nothing. And that would, that was an interesting idea, because that way you could proactively say, here's a proof. The other comment that is starting to relate very heavily here, and this is the last comment that I had, is that in DIDCOM V1, we have this thing where you either do DID exchange or the connections protocol right up front, and then you can start doing things. And I believe that the development of those protocols has led us to a mental model where whether a user accepts a connection or not is like a big deal. Right? It's important that they make a proper decision before they actually do that. And I don't actually think that's true. I think that's something that we've convinced ourselves that isn't super valuable. Typically, there's not a huge constraint issue or a massive spam issue for people that are actually making connections. And so what might actually make sense is for agents to just automatically accept the connection, engage in some protocols like credential exchange to receive some assertions of who they say they are, and then present a screen to the user that says, hey, do you want to accept this connection? I'm air quoting accept. But by then, you've actually been able to lean on protocols to do things like credential exchange in such a way that is much more meaningful. And then if you hit no, it's just going to delete the preliminary connection that it made. And if you hit yes, then it just keeps it. And so I think we've actually led ourselves down a harmful or an overly restrictive user experience because of this expectation that the user should accept them before they actually engage in any communication at all. And that's being drawn out a little bit in the DIDCOM version 2 discussions over in the Diff Working Group, because over there, we believe we've come up with a method of eliminating the need to actually have those things at all. Those two initialization protocols, which means that if you're going to make a connection, you can pass messages almost immediately. And the very first message you send could actually be, the initiation of a protocol for sending a verifiable credential that actually asserts things. And so I think that the desire for a better UX and sticking uncertified information in the very beginning is more of a side effect of a broken mental model that we've cursed ourselves with than necessarily the flow that we've, like, I think we have a false problem in front of us, I think is the right way to say it.
It also seems dangerous to accept a binary image to draw for the user from just some random pile of data that happens to be lying around. Think of all the interesting things you could show someone.
Yeah.
Or there have been attacks where there's a flaw in the common JPEG library stuff such that simply trying to process an image to render it on the screen activates a vulnerability. So, yeah.
The other thing I wonder is, if this is not the very first packet that gets sent, is it possible for us to just pack a random value into what's typically the previous packet so that there always is something you could treat as a nonce that kind of came from the other side of the communications, even though they didn't know that the nonce was for this specifically?
Yeah, that's the prover created nonce concept, right? Where you could just pick something, but intelligently picking the thing can be helpful. So the image thing is actually kind of a problem orthogonal to this, because if you're going to receive an image of any kind, whether it's in a credential or not, or maybe it's like a hash link where you have a signed thing with a link, you're still going to have the issue of what can be shown and the JPEG vulnerability of displaying them. So those are two both really good comments, but don't really argue for one way or the other.
That's true.
What I worry about here, what I'm trying to balance in my mind now, is the effort of trying to make something work now, but then move to a better model in the future. And hopefully we can help us not end up stuck on the now as we move forward. If DIDCOM version 2 has a way of actually doing this, where I could actually send you four messages and one of them is a credential, with a pre-chosen nonce, and another one is some, the beginning message of some other protocol, et cetera, you could actually receive three or four messages from me before I decide to actually do anything. But the big issue that I wanted to draw out is that I believe we've created our own false problem here. Typically, the issue here is the user experience of an individual, not really the user experience of an enterprise agent, right? And these are typically not high volume, which means that if you end up doing a little extra crypto to begin a connection and then realize that it's one you don't want and you throw it away, there's not a lot lost there. And I think that we've allowed ourselves to create a predominant mental model in Aries agents that is actually causing our own issue. So I don't know, given that the other folks that were in the conversation weren't, I don't know that we can, I don't know how much more we can productively do in this conversation, but the feedback that you guys have given, I like this, Daniel, is that if we do something, making it really obvious that this is like not the thing you should be trusting might help avert some situations.
So Sam, is there consideration about denial of service attacks being more likely? If you start accepting everything and then, you know, pushing it to more exchanges, then, you know, general mechanisms say, you know, for firewalls, you're trying to close off any rogue users as quickly as possible. So that would be, I like what you've said, but it's kind of going against what the general, that general line of thinking says, right?
So the point that you're making is a good one, I believe, and draws out the extensiveness of the mental model adjustment we would need to affect the change here. And what I mean is that right now, you generally ask the user's permission when a connection is first made, and then you're kind of willing to engage in any number of protocols. And I believe the mental model ought to be, here's a preliminary connection, and there's a couple of protocols I'll talk with you, but I don't want to have general credential. I'm not going to issue you anything, for example, before you prove to me something. And so there's a more limited set of things you're willing to do with that connection. And then, you know, while it's in its pending or preliminary stage, and then after important steps have occurred, like the presentation of some sort of proof or something, or then the rest of that can actually be engaged in. So from a spam prevention problem, this is not really very different. If I could draw a comparison, you know, if you pull up a web page, there's actually some exchanges that happen as part of TLS before you actually see the information on the page and decide, hey, this is not what I want to engage in. You've already done some crypto work. If that makes sense.
I hear you. I mean, I understand. It's, yeah.
So I think the mental, yeah. But I think you're right. If we are going to propose a mental model here, there's a bunch of aspects of that mental model that we need to consider and perhaps realize some adjustments there to make sure that we're not promoting generally unsafe behavior. Like, for example, if I have a connection like this, I'm not going to show them in my contact list, not until whatever steps I deem appropriate have been accomplished.
Yeah. Yep.
They might show up in a pending thing in a developer debug screen or something.
Or I can imagine there even being, it's not just two lists, those that are authenticated, those are not, but there could be even a rating, right? Of trustworthiness of, you know, of who is at the other end, right?
Well, and I think that trust is we're starting to see more reflections of trust actually in the user experience. Like, for example, I don't have, there are people that I would trust with money, but not with secrets, right?
Yeah.
And people that I would trust with secrets, but not with money.
Right. There's different axes along which you would measure that trustworthiness. Yeah.
Right. And so from a development perspective, we might be able to have a pending connection section that you could access. But, you know, the UX makes it clear that these are preliminary things because we're not yet satisfied with what they're asking. Cool. Other comments on this topic? Okay. The last thing that I have on the list will not take a half an hour, but I would love to show it. To do it though, I'm going to have to, I need to share my whole screen actually. This demo is given with my Indicio hat on. Indicio has decided that mediator agents are an important thing, and we don't yet have enough community support around making these sorts of things happen. So I'm going to tempt the demo gods a little bit. And I've got a classic Aries Alice and Bob scenario set up here. And it looks like it's going to work. Awesome. So I've got an Alice and Bob. And I want to, the first thing that I'm going to do is I'm going to introduce themselves to each other. In this case, I'm going to use... Bob as Alice's mediator is going to be the role here. So I'm going to first go through an introduction process, not that, you know, to establish the connections that we actually need. Here I've got Bob has an Alice and Alice has a Bob. That's pretty vanilla stuff. The next thing that I'm going to do is that I'm going to make a the transaction author agreement stuff. So I'm going to make a new a new did here, and this is just an alias used in the UI. And so here is the, you know, the ver key and the did for this. And this would be the ver key that you'd actually want to hand out to someone else in an invitation after you've arranged with your mediator. So so the idea then here is that I would like to ask Bob to route this ver key to me. And so ACAPI is what's on the back end here. And it actually has not all of the routing protocols, but it has like the route query and route update stuff that has been proposed in RFCs implemented. So that we haven't touched, it's the exact same. But then what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna use a routing module that I have here, and I'm gonna pick Bob as my mediator, and I'm gonna tell Bob and ask it to create the the routing entry for the route me for the ver key associated with the route me did. So when I hit go, nothing in particular actually happens, although that was curious. I don't know why that happened. Risk of demos. So in theory, what's actually happened now is that the Alice agent has sent to the Bob agent an update to say, here's the ver key, if you would please include that in the list of keys to route to me. And then there's a routing module. No, there's a mediator module that will list all of the routes that Bob actually has. Now, I realize that this is young from a UI perspective because this could be very, very many of them. But from an early perspective, this will show you that to Alice, this is the label that he has. This is the recipient key that he has configured. The connection ID is something that the agent uses internally to figure out how to get the messages to you. And then there's a timestamp of when that was actually created. And so this is the beginning of some stuff that we hope will make mediator agents easier to debug and to begin using if you're writing an agent. And that way, for example, you might be using a mobile app that then connects to the agent, but this would at least give you the ability to see which routing keys Bob in the role of a mediator has listed. Ideally, some grouping and some counts and some usage information would also be useful here. But those things would require changes to the agent, which we haven't got to yet. We're just using the routing stuff that's already in the ACAPI code base. I believe that wasn't BCGov that added that. There was another community contributor that added that a few months ago. And so that's the demo, is just that we were able to engage in these protocols. And now Bob contains a routing key for the Alice agent. One of the uses that we have thought of but have not yet implemented is that the toolbox right now can only actually connect to an agent that doesn't need a mediator the way that it's currently set up. But it could actually use this protocol. If you connect it to a mediator, the agent or the toolbox itself could use that in the connection profile, which means you'd be able to do things like have the toolbox coordinate with the mediator and then issue create a connection that actually gets handed to a phone, and you'd end up with a relationship between the toolbox and in a phone, such that you could then craft messages using the compose window and have it sent directly to the phone and get responses, et cetera, from the phone as part of a testing tool. And so that would be something neat. The other thing that I've recognized is that nearly all of the demos, and indeed the exact same demo I'm using here, uses ngrok in order to expose the inbound endpoints to agents. And that's inconvenient for a couple of reasons. If you have a free version of ngrok, it resets the connection after 8 hours, et cetera. And so it would be useful if we had better ways of using mediators for demos instead of using ngrok. So my Aries toolbox, or the Alice agent rather, behind could coordinate with a mediator that lives outside on the public internet and is routable to be able to receive those inbound messages. And that would eliminate the need to use something specific like ngrok to enable demos to happen, or training, or other scenarios of that nature. That's about the demo. I told you it wasn't going to take 30 minutes. Any thoughts, comments?
I'm super jazzed to see a mediator role get explicitly studied and exposed. And there's a conversation thread happening at the W3C right now about endpoint privacy. It was started by Adrian Gropper, And it made me realize that many of the ideas that we have discussed for a long time could answer some questions that other people have now begun to wrestle with and have started on those problems from a different perspective. So I think the concept of mediators needs a number of advocates right now. I think it would be good if we could explain our mental model, and this demo is a really good beginning to that. Thank you.
I'd like to have a fancier one, like actually passing real messages back and forth, but this is at least the beginning. The other thing that I'll mention, this isn't merged yet, because one of the things that's needed is that there is now an admin routing and an admin mediator protocol that's in use between the toolbox and the agent that's running it. And I'm trying to be careful in creating those so that they are not ACOPI specific. Meaning if you have a mediator agent that you would like to be able to use the toolbox in this way, the only thing you'd need to do is actually implement the admin protocol in order to make that happen. And then the toolbox stuff will just work with that agent when it's connected. So there's nothing, though I'm using ACOPI, there's nothing explicitly ACOPI involved here. That's just the code base we started from for this particular use. There's a couple things that ACOPI doesn't implement. One of them that kind of needs to be added to this screen is there's a proposed protocol for the will you route for me, which is the initial question, even before you actually start passing keys. Is to ask, hey, you know, will you be a router for me or a mediator? And the answer is yes or no, but the yes also needs to include yes, and here is the endpoint that you should use when you tell other people and potentially routing keys as well. That is not currently implemented by ACOPI, but would be a useful thing. And that way, if Bob doesn't want to be a mediator, he just says no. And then Alice knows that Bob's not going to do that. And so that's a useful thing as well. And then in the asking, will you route for me? There's other processes that can actually occur. They're like, sure, I will if you pay me money, right? Or I will if you can prove to me that you're a student at this university. There's other types of interactions that may actually happen there. That way, a university could run a mediator agent on behalf of its students, but doesn't expect to run, you know, to run mediation for the whole universe. These protocols are actually they're standard in the sense that they are useful for open source projects that want to do this. These are not the same protocols that must be supported in a service provider sense. If you ship both a mediator and a mobile app, then these are, you could use these, but you don't have to. You could use anything internally that actually makes sense because of the coupling between those two. But if you have an enterprise agent or a mobile agent in particular that could use mediator services, then having some standard ones and some standard open source things that will provide those and support those protocols is one way to move forward there. And so that was what we're trying to add a little bit more to, just from a utility perspective.
As someone who's been trying to pick up open source code bases to do some of this work, is it fair to put pressure on people to use these protocols even if they do have tight coupling just for interoperability's sake?
Pressure is a strong word. I think that if a provider has an interest in providing mediation services outside of their own coupled products, I would heavily recommend that they do this because other software, I believe, will trend towards these protocols, as a way to rally around them. But if there's no interest by that provider in providing mediation services in general, then I don't know that supporting this would actually be very helpful. There's some deeper questions as it surrounds multi domains, meaning multiple agents in my domain as a user that come from different providers. I may have a laptop agent from provider A and a mobile agent from provider B, and we have not yet as a community well explored the implications of such a multi-provider domain world and the types of interoperability that may actually be required there. It may not require anything else. It may require a lot more. We just haven't explored it, I think, very well. That was a long answer, Nathan, to a short question.
It was a loaded question. You did well.
Oh, good. Yes. So I hope that there are other things that Indicio has identified as things that would help, particularly in mediation land. And so I know there's some ongoing effort there. If you're interested and you want to collaborate or use stuff or whatever, then interest is of course there. There's PRs for both the toolbox itself and for the Akapai toolbox plugin that they just need a little bit of polish before they're actually submitted as PRs. The other thing that I'll mention is that Akapai itself does not support all of the admin protocols to do this, but there is a plugin which adds support for those admin protocols. And so that's relatively tightly coupled to Akapai. The one in the repo right now is tied to an older commit of Akapai, and I am nearly done with the work of updating that plugin to work with the newest release of Akapai, which is 5.2. I actually completed the work for 5.1, and then they released 5.2, so I have some verification to do there and possibly some minor updates before I release that. So if you're using the newer release of Akapai, then the toolbox plugin will be able to handle that. And of course, any other agents that support the same admin protocols will be able to work with the toolbox as well. So if you're writing your own, there's the documentation for those is in the Aries toolbox repo. And if you add those, then it will work. It makes that work by running the Discover Features protocol. And then when it finds let me go find one. So here's, that's just basic message. So actually here's the transaction author agreement one. You saw that pop up when I went to go make it did. There's an admin protocol for that that makes it work. Here is invitations. These are not sorted. So here's admin mediator. So if your agent returns that it supports this particular protocol, then the UI module will appear in the left menu as when you're connected to that particular agent. So the toolbox automatically customizes itself for the abilities of the agent that it's connected to. Cool. Any other questions? Awesome. So we are at the end of our agenda. We can either go early or we can talk about other topics. We previously talked about the BBS Plus signatures. Is there more conversation desired on that or on any other topics?
Actually, Jakub here from APSA. I would like to maybe I have a maybe question back to that profile and invitation topic, and it's related to what you mentioned. Like, if you would like to add a logo URL or some image of the connection on the other side to the invitation, you know, to show user this picture, you know, in a connection screen. So I kind of like this Daniel mention with expressing there are some fields potentially vulnerable for some attacks, and other points are like quite understandable. But I'm like curious what's the recommended way how to do it right now, because I ask actually in some Rocket Chat in some channel. And we are discussing it in our team, and we are not sure how to approach it, how to edit. Should be it in invitation, or should we approach it in other way? So, what's your recommended way how to approach it right now?
It's a bummer we don't have Tomislav anymore. He their product actually does it in a particular way. Although I think it's I think he's mentioned it's in the same conversation, it's fairly non-standard. There actually isn't a way, and so one of the ways to come up with the recommended way is to propose something and then bring it up for conversation so that we can discuss the various aspects of it and you know, maybe propose adjustments or other things to accomplish what we need. So at this point, there actually isn't. In the very beginnings of the connections protocol, we had the discussion about what we should do there. And the compromise was to leave label as a self-attested attribute, but not support anything else as of yet. And so as a result, we actually don't. So those products that actually have implemented something have done something outside of the regular protocol. The way that DIDCOM is designed is that if you don't understand a field, like the field is one you didn't expect given the message you receive, you're supposed to ignore it, which means it is possible to put custom stuff in there, but it won't be received or accepted by all agents. And so given that we don't have something, I think my recommendation is to propose something and then continue that conversation with what you've proposed to see what the community thinks about it.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that seems... reasonable, because that's actually our first idea was introducing some our custom field, you know, logo URL for example into the invitation. So that was like first idea. I was thinking about putting something in attachment, but I'm not sure, like, is it possible for an invitation to have attachments in it?
It is. It certainly is if we describe it to be so, right? If you come up with a proposal on how this could be done, then you could make that an optional field in an invitation, and then the chances of more of broader support go up, as you have additional. If we define that in the out of band invitations, and so one of the ways you could make a proposal is with a PR to the out of band protocol, suggesting an attachment field or just fields that actually contain that information, and then we can continue the discussion that we've had alongside that.
Okay. Yeah. My colleague has like idea about putting this information into the document, and which is related to public DIDs. Like, is it viable idea? Is it good idea to do that in this way? You know, what do you think about it?
I think it's generally not, but personally, there's lots of opinions out there. I think that, and this is sort of the same way that I feel about the DID exchange protocols. Its purpose is to exchange DIDs, and I think that we've sort of applied a different mental model on top of that that's maybe unfortunate. Now, I don't know how we should move forward. We clearly have the mental model now, so do we come up with a compromise in the meantime, or do we attempt to correct the mental model now? And I'm really not sure about the right answer there. I have decided that it's probably worth trying to articulate in words what I described earlier about the mental model, so that that's something that we can consider as part of the conversation. I mean, maybe other people agree with me, maybe they don't. But even if they agree with me, it may not be the right thing to instantly correct that mental model at this particular moment, just in the landscape of trying to get stuff done and move forward. So, I don't. One of the interesting things is we've actually had very little conversation in the community about what a profile object actually would be. Let's say you wanted to share a profile, even over a verifiable credential. There hasn't been a lot of conversation about what exactly that would look like. So if I make a connection with Nathan, for example, and leave aside how the information gets communicated, but what is the actual schema or the description of the information that actually comes from Nathan, and how is that similar to the same type of information that might be provided by a business if I'm making a connection there? And that information would be really useful in a contact list. Having images, for example, in a contact list or avatars would be really useful, but we haven't really had that discussion in this community. So in addition to not having a good way to define it, we actually haven't talked deeply about what that should look like, even if something like verifiable credentials were to be used.
Okay, cool. Thank you. Thank you very much. I'll pass the information and we'll discuss it and return back to you guys in chat or in some PR potentially. So great to hear this information and this discussion. So thank you.
I thanks for asking it. I feel bad when I answer with "Hey" with an invitation to do work, but the involvement of everyone and perspectives of everyone is what makes things move forward so well in this community. So I appreciate that. Any other questions or comments or topics for discussion on anything? I will mention that next week we're going to have a discussion on tracing and figuring out the general consensus of the beginning of the conversation, as I recall last week, was that BCGov has started to work on some tracing stuff that that appeared to be outside of the original vision of the tracing RFC that Daniel wrote. And so one of the discussions was, having some conversation around that to figure out the tension there is that should the RFC be updated? Should this be something different entirely that solves a similar purpose? And that was the conversation, but Stephen Curran asked me to postpone that given Canada Day so he can be part of that conversation. Any topics that anyone would like addressed in the next week or two? All right. Appreciate you being here. And I will get this recording posted. And we will see you all around the internet. And hope your week is good. And we appreciate you being involved.
If you have time for one more question, Sam, I have one more question that I was slow on the mute button with.
You were slow on the mute. I didn't wait a full Nathan, though. It was more like a quarter Nathan. Sure. What do you got, Nathan?
We've been working on adding images into verifiable credentials for things like driver's license pictures. And we're also starting to think about how we might do a rendering of a credential for a UI or an app as part of how that credential gets displayed in different applications that might want to render or draw it. I've been looking at things like how different mobile operating systems use JSON packages to display things in their wallet softwares and a few other things that are similar to that to try to look for patterns that make sense. We've also been using or maybe abusing the attachment formats to add the hash as an attribute to the credential, but then also attach the binary data when we transfer credentials around. And so I was curious from the community if anyone else is working on similar problems or if anyone's written things down in RFCs that are either current, abandoned, or in progress that we might draw inspiration from or collaborate on.
Evernim is working on that. And I asked Devin to please take it to the community, but this was like 3 months ago, 4 months ago. And I don't know what Devin did, but I can find the document and see if it looks familiar to you.
That would be wonderful. And if it's all right, I'll probably, if there's someone like that on your team that we can reach out with and have a conversation with, I'm also okay, you know, picking up that work. If they don't want to lead it in the community, we can try to push some of the process stuff forward if they're uncomfortable with that.
Awesome. I'll send you, Nathan, I don't know if I have a new work email address for you. Can you have mine. Can you just email me and then I'll reply to it with some info?
That sounds great. I'll also Carbon Cam, who's been working on this on our side.
Okay. The other possibility is maybe we just talk by Rocket Chat so it's not on email. Either one will work for me, whatever you like.
Sounds great.
Awesome. Very cool. Any others? I feel compelled to wait a full Nathan after not giving Nathan enough time. That's kind of ironic, huh?
Well, I felt bad because you're doing such a great job wrapping up the meeting and I just knew I was going to spoil it.
Yeah, I'm super bothered. No, more stuff is always good. Okay, folks. And I'll call it. Thanks, Thomas, for presenting and all the comments and involvement, and we will see you guys around.